Aragorn had brought torches from Dunharrow, and now he went ahead, bearing one aloft. And Eladan, with another, went at the rear, and Gimli, stumbling behind, strove to overtake him. He could see nothing but the dim flame of the torches, but if the company halted, there seemed an endless whisper of voices all about him, a murmur of words in no tongue that he had ever heard before. Nothing assailed the company, nor withstood their passage, and yet steadily fear grew on the dwarf as he went on. Most of all because he knew now that there could be no turning back. All the paths behind were thronged by an unseen host that followed in the dark. So time unreckoned passed, until Gimli saw a sight that he was ever afterwards loath to recall. The road was wide, as far as he could judge, but now the company came suddenly into a great empty space, and there were no longer any walls upon either side. The dread was so heavy on him that he could hardly walk. Away to the left something glittered in the gloom as Aragorn's torch drew near. Then Aragorn halted and went to look what it might be.
"Does he feel no fear?" muttered the dwarf. "In any other cave Gimli, Gloin's son, would have been the first to run to the gleam of gold, but not here. Let it lie."
Nonetheless he drew near, and saw Aragorn kneeling, while Eladan held aloft both torches. Before him were the bones of a mighty man. He had been clad in mail, and still his harness lay there whole, for the cavern's air was as dry as dust, and his hauberk was gilded. His belt was of gold and garnets, and rich with gold was the helm upon his bony head, face downward on the floor. He had fallen near the far wall of the cave, as now could be seen, and before him stood a stony door closed fast. His finger bones were still clawing at the cracks. A notched and broken sword lay by him, as if he had hewn at the rock in his last despair. Aragorn did not touch him, but after gazing silently for a while he rose and sighed.
"Hither shall the flowers of Simbel Muna come never unto world's end," he murmured. "Nine mounds and seven there are, now green with grass, and through all the long years he has lain at the door that he could not unlock. Whither does it lead? Why would it pass? None shall ever know. For that is not my errand," he cried, turning back and speaking to the whispering darkness behind. "Keep your hoards and your secrets hidden in the accursed years. Speed only, we ask. Let us pass, and then come. I summon you to the stone of Erech." There was no answer, unless it were an utter silence more dreadful than the whispers before. And then a chill blast came, in which the torches flickered and went out, and could not be rekindled. Of the time that followed, 1 hour or many, Gimli remembered little. The others pressed on, but he was ever hindmost, pursued by a groping horror that seemed always just about to seize him, and a rumour came after him, like the shadow sound of many feet. He stumbled on until he was crawling like a beast on the ground, and felt that he could endure no more. He must either find an ending and escape, or run back in madness to meet the following fear. Suddenly he heard the tinkle of water, a sound hard and clear as a stone, falling into a dream of dark shadow. Light grew, and lo! The company passed through another gateway, high-arched and broad, and a rill ran out beside them. And beyond, going steeply down, was a road between sheer cliffs, knife-edged against the sky far above. So deep and narrow was that chasm that the sky was dark, and in it small stars glinted. Yet, as Gimli after learned, it was still 2 hours ere sunset of the day on which they had set out from Dunharrow. Though for all that he could then tell, it might have been twilight in some later year or in some other world. The company now mounted again, and Gimli returned to Legolas. They rode in file, and evening came on, and a deep blue dusk, and still fear pursued them. Legolas, turning to speak to Gimli, looked back, and the dwarf saw before his face the glitter in the elf's bright eyes. Behind them rode Eladan, last of the company, but not the last of those that took the downward road. "The dead are following," said Legolas. "I see shapes of men and of horses, and pale banners like shreds of cloud, and spears like winter thickets on a misty night. The dead are following." "Yes, the dead ride behind. They have been summoned," said Eladan. The company came at last out of the ravine, as suddenly as if they had issued from a crack in a wall, and there lay the uplands of a great vale before them, and the streams beside them went down with a cold voice over many falls.
"Where in Middle-earth are we?" said Gimli,
and Eladan answered, "We've descended from the uprising of the Morthond, the long chill river that flows at last to the sea that washes the walls of Dol Amroth. You will not need to ask hereafter how comes its name. Blackroot men call it." The Morthond vale made a great bay that beat up against the sheer southern faces of the mountains. Its steep slopes were grass-grown, but all was grey in that hour, for the sun had gone, and far below lights twinkled in the homes of men. The vale was rich, and many folk dwelt there. Then, without turning, Aragorn cried aloud, so that all could hear,
"Friends, forget your weariness. Ride now, ride! We must come to the stone of Erech ere this day passes, and long still is the way."
So without looking back, they rode the mountain fields until they came to a bridge over the growing torrent and found a road that went down into the land. Lights went out in house and hamlet as they came, and doors were shut, and folk that were afield cried in terror and ran wild like hunted deer. Ever there rose the same cry in the gathering night.
"The King of the Dead! The King of the Dead has come upon us!"
Bells were ringing far below, and all men fled before the face of Aragorn, but the grey company in their haste rode like hunters, until their horses were stumbling with weariness. And thus, just ere midnight, and in a darkness as black as the caverns in the mountains, they came at last to the hills of Erech. Long had the terror of the dead lain upon that hill and upon the empty fields about it. For upon the top stood a black stone, round as a great globe, the height of a man, though its half was buried in the ground. Unearthly it looked, as though it had fallen from the sky, as some believed. But those who remembered still the lore of Westerness told that it had been brought out of the ruin of Numenor and there set by Isildur at his landing. None of the people of the valley dared to approach it, nor would they dwell near, for they said that it was a trysting place of the Shadow Men, and there they would gather in times of fear, thronging round the stone and whispering. To that stone the company came and halted in the dead of night. Then Elrohir gave to Aragorn a silver horn, and he blew upon it, and it seemed to those that stood near that they heard a sound of answering horns, as if it was an echo in deep caves far away. No other sound they heard, and yet they were aware of a great host gathered all about the hill on which they stood, and a chill wind like the breath of ghosts came down from the mountains. But Aragorn dismounted, and standing by the stone, he cried in a great voice,
"Oathbreakers, why have ye come?"
And a voice was heard out of the night that answered him, as if from far away,
"To fulfill our oath and have peace."
Then Aragorn said,
"The hour has come at last. Now I go to Pelagir upon Anduin, and ye shall come after me. And when all this land is clean of the servants of Sauron, I will hold the oath fulfilled, and ye shall have peace and depart forever. For I am Elessar, Isildur's heir of Gondor."
And with that he bade Halbarad unfurl the great standard which he had brought, and behold, it was black, and if there was any device upon it, it was hidden in the darkness. Then there was silence, and not a whisper nor a sigh was heard again all the night long. The company camped beside the stone, but they slept little, because of the dread of the shadows that hedged them round. But when the dawn came, cold and pale, Aragorn rose at once, and he led the company forth upon the journey of greatest haste and weariness that any of them had known, save he alone, and only his will held them to go on. No other mortal men could have endured it, none but the Dúnedain of the north, and with them Gimli the dwarf and Legolas of the elves. They passed Tarlang's neck and came into Lamadon, and the shadow host pressed behind, and fear went on before them, until they came to Calibel upon Kiril, and the sun went down like blood behind Pinath Gelin, away in the west behind them. The township and the fords of Kiril they found deserted, for many men had gone away to war, and all that were left fled to the hills at the rumour of the coming of the King of the Dead. But the next day there came no dawn, and the great company passed on into the darkness of the storm of Mordor, and were lost to mortal sight. But the dead followed them. Chapter 3. The Muster of Rohan. Now all roads were running together to the east to meet the coming of war and the onset of the shadow. And even as Pippin stood at the great gate of the city and saw the prince of Dol Amroth ride in with his banners, the king of Rohan came down out of the hills. Day was waning. In the last rays of the sun, the riders cast long, pointed shadows that went on before them. Darkness had already crept beneath the murmuring fir woods that clothed the steep mountainsides. The king rode now slowly at the end of the day. Presently the path turned round a huge, bare shoulder of rock and plunged into the gloom of soft-sighing trees. Down, down they went in a long, winding file. When at last they came to the bottom of the gorge, they found that evening had fallen in the deep places. The sun was gone. Twilight lay upon the waterfalls. All day far below them, a leaping stream had run down from the high pass behind, cleaving its narrow way between pine-clad walls, and now through a stony gate it flowed out and passed into a wider vale. The riders followed it, and suddenly Harrowdale lay before them, loud with the noise of waters in the evening. There the white Snowborn, joined by the lesser stream, went rushing, fuming on the stones, down to Edoras and the green hills and the plains. Away to the right at the head of the great dale, the mighty Starkhorn loomed up above its vast buttresses swathed in cloud, but its jagged peak, clothed in everlasting snow, gleamed far above the world, blue-shadowed upon the east, red-stained by the sunset in the west. Merry looked out in wonder upon this strange country, of which he had heard many tales upon their long road. It was a skyless world, in which his eye, through dim gulfs of shadowy air, saw only ever-mounting slopes, great walls of stone behind great walls, and frowning precipices wreathed with mist. He sat for a moment half-dreaming, listening to the noise of water, the whisper of dark trees, the crack of stone, and the vast waiting silence that brooded behind all sound. He loved mountains, or he had loved the thought of them marching on the edge of stories brought from far away, but now he was borne down by the insupportable weight of Middle-earth. He longed to shut out the immensity in a quiet room by a fire. He was very tired, for though they had ridden slowly, they had ridden with very little rest. Hour after hour, for nearly 3 weary days, he had jogged up and down over passes and through long dales and across many streams. Sometimes, where the way was broader, he had ridden at the king's side, not noticing that many of the riders smiled to see the two together, the hobbit on his little shaggy grey pony, and the lord of Rohan on his great white horse. Then he had talked to Théoden, telling him about his home and the doings of the shire folk, or listening in turn to tales of the Mark and of its mighty men of old. But most of the time, especially on this last day, Merry had ridden by himself, just behind the king, saying nothing, and trying to understand the slow, sonorous speech of Rohan that he heard the men behind him using. It was a language in which there seemed to be many words that he knew, though spoken more richly and more strongly than in the Shire, yet he could not piece the words together. At times some rider would lift up his clear voice in stirring song, and Merry felt his heart leap, though he didn't know what it was about. All the same, he'd been lonely, and never more so than now at the day's end. He wondered where in all this strange world Pippin had got to, and what would become of Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli. Then suddenly, like a cold touch on his heart, he thought of Frodo and Sam. "I'm forgetting them," he said to himself reproachfully. "And yet they're more important than all the rest of us. And I came to help them. But now they must be hundreds of miles away, if they're still alive." He shivered. "Harrowdale at last," said Éomer. "Our journey is almost at an end." They halted. The paths out of the narrow gorge fell steeply. Only a glimpse, as through a tall window, could be seen of the great valley in the gloaming below. A single small light could be seen twinkling by the river.
"The journey is over, maybe," said Théoden, "but I have far yet to go. Last night the moon was full, and in the morning I shall ride to Edoras to the gathering of the Mark."
"But if you would take my counsel," said Éomer in a low voice, "you would then return hither until the war is over, lost or won." Théoden smiled.
"Nay, my son, for so I will call you, speak not the soft words of worm tongue in my old ears." He drew himself up and looked back at the long line of his men fading into the dusk behind. "Long years in the space of days, it seems, since I rode west. But never will I lean on a staff again. If the war is lost, what good will be my hiding in the hills? And if it's won, what grief will it be, even if I fall, spending my last strength? But we will leave this now. Tonight I will lie in the hold of Dunharrow. One evening of peace at least is left us. Let us ride on."
In the deepening dusk they came down into the valley. Here the Snowbourne flowed near to the western walls of the dale, and soon the path led them to a ford, where the shallow waters murmured loudly on the stones. The ford was guarded. As the king approached, many men sprang up out of the shadows of the rocks, and when they saw the king they cried with glad voices, "Théoden King! Théoden King! The King of the Mark returns!" Then one blew a long call on a horn. It echoed in the valley. Other horns answered it, and light shone out across the river. And suddenly there rose a great chorus of trumpets from high above, sounding from some hollow place, as it seemed, that gathered their notes into one voice and sent it rolling and beating on the walls of stone. So the King of the Mark came back victorious out of the west to Dunharrow, beneath the feet of the White Mountains. There he found the remaining strength of his people already assembled, for as soon as his coming was known, captains rode to meet him at the ford, bearing messages from Gandalf. Dúnhéir, chieftain of the folk of Harrowdale, was at their head.
"At dawn 3 days ago, lord," he said, "Shadowfax came like a wind out of the west to Edoras, and Gandalf brought tidings of your victory to gladden our hearts. But he brought also word from you to hasten the gathering of the riders, and then came the winged shadow."
"The winged shadow," said Théoden, "we saw it also. But that was in the dead of night before Gandalf left us."
"Maybe, lord," said Dúnhéir. "Yet the same, or another like to it, a flying darkness in the shape of a monstrous bird, passed over Edoras that morning, and all men were shaken with fear. For it stooped upon Meadowseld, and as it came low, almost to the gable, there came a cry that stopped our hearts. Then it was that Gandalf counseled us not to assemble in the fields, but to meet you here in the valley under the mountains. And he bade us to kindle no more lights or fires than barest need asked. So it has been done. Gandalf spoke with great authority. We trust that it is as you would wish. Nought has been seen in Harrowdale of these evil things."
"It is well," said Théoden. "I will ride now to the hold, and there, before I go to rest, I will meet the marshals and captains. Let them come to me as soon as may be."
The road now led eastward, straight across the valley, which was at that point little more than half a mile in width. Flats and meads of rough grass, grey now in the falling night, lay all about, but in front, on the far side of the dale, Medi saw a frowning wall, a last outlier of the great roots of the Starkhorn, cloven by the river in ages past. On all the level spaces there was great concourse of men. Some thronged to the roadside, hailing the king and the riders from the west with glad cries, but stretching away into the darkness behind, there were ordered rows of tents and booths, and lines of picketed horses, and great store of arms, and piled spears bristling like thickets of new-planted trees. Now all the great assembly was falling into shadow, and yet, though the night chill blew cold from the heights, no lanterns glowed, no fires were lit. Watchmen, heavily cloaked, paced to and fro. Merry wondered how many riders there were. He couldn't guess their number in the gathering gloom, but it looked to him like a great army, many thousands strong. While he was peering from side to side, the king's party came up under the looming cliff on the eastern side of the valley, and there suddenly the path began to climb, and Merry looked up in amazement. He was on a road the like of which he had never seen before, a great work of men's hands in years beyond the reach of song. Upward it wound, coiling like a snake, boring its way across the sheer slope of rock. Steep as a stair, it looped backwards and forwards as it climbed. Up it horses could walk,